Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Crime Wire. This is a special evening, an hour for, it happens to be National Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and we just thought that we would put out an hour show if you are in a violent relationship, if you are being stalked, if you don't know what to do, if you are having after effects of, after you're out of the relationship and you just don't have anywhere to turn or support. We thought we'd dedicate this hour for you and those who need direction and assistance when, you know, again, it's before, during, and after a relationship, because they are so difficult. People think that because they can't see what goes on behind closed doors that there is no crime, when we all know that there is. Joining us tonight are Tricia McKnight. She's the author of My Justice, The Story of Her Childhood Described by Sexual Abuse by Her Stepfather and Severe Neglect by Her Mother. The behaviors learned and accepted as a child led McKnight to bad choices in adulthood, and violence against her continued for many years within the marriage when she became an adult. Welcome to the show, Trish.
Hey, Susan, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for having
me. You're welcome. Talk about how much childhood destroys, before you're an adult and when you grow up in this kind of environment, how much it really destroys your self-confidence and who you are.
I didn't know who I was. I didn't know that there was, I knew that I felt something inside. I knew that all this bad that was around my life wasn't normal. But as a kid, you're so scared, and you are just taught, you know, back in those days in the 70s, we were just taught to obey, listen, and be quiet, you know, so you didn't talk about it.
Don't you think, though, that kids today are taught the same thing? I mean, that was your normal. And think about all the kids today, that's their normal. I don't think it had much to do with the 70s. It's just that we discuss it probably more, but I think the secrets are more kept away from everybody as technology increases.
It's the kids, I think, I know with my kids, it was a matter of, I saw a lot buried in them from what they saw going on in their home. And that, I didn't see it until they were teenagers. And I saw how they were reacting to things around them. And I could pick up on signals of how they were feeling and being scared. And whenever their stepfather would come into the house, and how they would totally avoid any kind of family get-togethers whatsoever. They didn't want anything to do with it. And I could just tell they were just living in complete fear. They didn't know what to do when he was around. So that's whenever I decided, you got to, these kids live in it day after day after day. And it becomes a pattern of trained behavior. This is what you know. This is all you know. This is what you accept. This is what you live in. This is, you may go to school, but all you can think about is what's going on at home. And it encircles your whole life. There was no me in my life. My life was controlled completely by my stepfather and by all of the responsibility that my mother had put on me. It was, there was no me time. There was no kid time. There was no Trish time. It was just all whatever they needed. I was a family caregiver at 11. That was my job.
And that's very common. And also joining us is Lindsay Tulsa. She's the author of Beyond the Tears, A True Survivor Story. It begins with her therapy sessions where she reveals dysfunctional family relationships, incest, domestic violence, sexual abuse. Her story illustrates physical, emotional, and spiritual transformation. Thank you for joining us both.
Hi, Susan. Hi, Trish.
Yeah. Hi, Lynn.
So, Lynn, you talk about you know, one of the first things that hits me about your book is the suicide attempts.
Yes.
And that place of uncertainty. How common is suicide in these types of situations, these type of relationships?
Well, I learned later on in life that actually my suicide attempts were probably related to the fact that I was a victim of incest. And those who have experienced sexual assault, whether it's incest or rape, not from a family member, are 13 times more likely to attempt suicide than those who have not been sexually assaulted. So to me, that might as well be 100%. I mean, that's a lot of people attempting suicide because they have experienced sexual assault. Now, I don't know if that's the only factor. My father attempted suicide many, many times when I was a child. You know, we would find him hanging. We would find him shooting bullets at the ceiling. We would find him with his head in the oven, and until he actually completed when I was 19. So maybe it was also a part of my chemistry.
Do you really believe that? I don't think so.
I don't know, but my first attempt, I was 10 years old. Now, I can't say that I wanted to die. I wanted, at 10, for the pain to end. And so I took a bottle of Excedrin, and all I got was the runs. And, I don't know. Why? Do you believe something different? Do you not believe in the chemistry of...
I think that's an excuse, if you will, in a way. I think that that is not true. I don't think that we are predestined, you know, because I'm living proof of that. I don't believe in that. I think that through the years, people assume or put labels on things. And I think that, yeah, certain things happen because you don't know what to do with them at that age. But then when you get older, you decide, or you try to make sense of things. Hopefully you get help. But it's not, you know, I don't think that... It's a chemical. I don't believe a lot of times when somebody says, well, alcoholism runs in the family. I think it's a choice. Maybe I'm not the norm.
I believe it could also go both ways, yeah, because like you said, it is when you get to a certain point, you can make a choice to either do or not do, but in some cases,
last week in Southern California, there was a man who went into a salon.
Yes.
And shot 9 people.
Yeah.
One survived and 8 died. One was his ex-wife. They've been in court since 2007.
Right.
He had arrested without his antidepressants or antipsychotics medication. They had said that he had been in some kind of an accident in 2007, and he was on pain pills, and they attributed it to that. And what's sad about that is that's mothers without custody. That's what that is. That is anger, and it's rage. And is anybody going to blame anything on other than the fact that he planned this out? He wore body armor. He came in with weaponry. He planned this out. So how insane can you be? Is it going to be attributed to something? Connecticut, the Pettit trial just ended, and it was where those two hoodlums went in and tortured and murdered an entire family of Dr. Pettit's. And he survived, but his 2 children and his wife did not. And in the second killer's trial, they put on his sexual abuse in childhood on the stand. I guess we need to stop making excuses. And it seems like in these cases, when these people do these horrific acts, that the ones that they do to the ones who have to survive and who do survive, Lynn, you and you, Trish, that what happens is, you're forced to do certain things. You're forced to fly right. You're forced to get out of your own way. And you don't make excuses. You just do the best you can to survive. But yet, we go ahead and give somebody like this person in California who killed, or anybody else, we seem to give them whatever they need to get well or to cope. And yet, mothers are losing their children.
Right.
Victims are growing up in these environments. And it seems to be that no one's really paying attention to the issue of domestic violence, stalking, mothers without custody. You've got a lot of men's groups who are coming out, and I call it barking because that's what they're doing. When it isn't healthy sometimes for both parents to have custody of the child, as we've seen in these cases. So, you know, and Tris, with what you do on the online group, because you facilitate an online group for survivors, it's mm-hmm. very difficult to try to help some of these people because, you know, all of this court proceedings and
oh, yes.
their children's oh, yes. rights are, and theirs are being taken away. What do you say to them?
It is really, because I've been on both sides, both actually being in the courtroom and fighting for my own kids, and also just working with anybody that's connected with me out here, and it is so devastating. Nothing takes your soul away like having your children taken away. And when you know that the person that's got them is an abuser, and you've gone through their abuse, and you've seen how they react with your children, and then you find out that they've got custody of your children. My children were severely hurt during the 4 years that my ex-husband had them. And when I got them back, I didn't get back the same baby. My babies were forever gone because a part of them had died. And I hold that grudge to this day. And I know that every mother out there, every parent out there that's going through the same thing, it's very, very deep. And all you can do is really just let them know that they got to keep documenting everything. They've got to keep talking and never shut up. They've got to keep it going. Even a lot of times it'll go to the point and it gets so tragic that, you know, gag orders are issued and then they can't reach out to anybody. But if they can in any way, shape, or form, reach out to somebody. I fought this up in Pennsylvania all by myself. And, of course, you know, his brother was a powerful attorney and his parents had the money. So, and I had nothing. I had my job. I had moved there chasing after him to
Lynn,
go ahead.
Colson, why don't you talk about the children who take on the blame for what's broken because they can't fix it. It's like Humpty Dumpty.
Susan, it sounds like you're referring to the blog that I wrote where I had referred to a lesson I learned from John Bradshaw, who wrote Coming Home and was credited for starting the inner child movement. And what I read from him was that children who witness violence are traumatized. So when I was 10 and I'm thinking I'm going to take a bottle of Excedrin to ease the pain, or maybe I just want to, you know, go to sleep for a while and maybe I'll wake up and be an angel, what I want to do is escape the violence that I'm experiencing. And so when I started reading books like John Bradshaw, self-help books, I learned that exactly that. Children who witness violence in the home are as traumatized as if they are experiencing the beatings or even the killings. As you know, as if they are experiencing that physicality their own selves. So that was a powerful lesson for me to not minimize what I had witnessed.
Correct.
And, do you think, Trish, that we minimize what we see in these type of relationships?
Absolutely. Especially if when I honestly believe that it's a pattern of trained behavior. You grew up in it. It's what you know. It's what your normal is. So in your adult life, you know, you tend to follow on a pattern, especially if you're from an abusive childhood. It kind of goes with the flow a lot of times, not all times, but a lot of times it'll go in the flow. So then you see, you just accept this. This is your normal. But your children, this is now becoming their normal. And I think that it, a lot of times we don't see that till it's too late. You know, they're already...
We're going to take a phone call. Area code 360, do you have a question or a comment?
Yes, I have a question and a comment, I guess. I have three children that are adults. I have one child who's been kidnapped by my abuser. And you know, I am going through the hell of this. I've been going through it for 5 years now, and now he's got a restraining order against me for God only knows what lie he told the courts to make them do that to me.
Are you in a different state?
No, we're in the same state.
Okay.
And he's like, my son is like, you know, 60 miles away from me, and I can't touch him, talk to him, speak to him, whatever. We've been going, he's been doing this for years, for 5 years, like I said. How do I explain the pain to my children, my other children, my adult children? Unfortunately, they've watched me just deteriorate into, I mean, I'm still functioning as a person, but I am now on Social Security. I went from a working, thriving woman down to now I have PTSD so bad because of what he's done to me. He's threatened to kill me millions of times. I'm in hiding, yada, yada. I mean, how do you tell your children that you're not, it's not like you've chosen to be a coward or a victim or a boo-boo crying baby all the time because you can't cope with the loss sometimes. You know what I mean? And it's just to the point of where you can't, you've tried to get over it. You've tried to, but they don't understand that. They keep
saying, your two other kids don't understand.
My adult kids are
how,
like.
How old is the one the boy that's left? How old is he?
He is 14. He'll be 15 in April.
And do you ever get to talk to him at all? Or
no,
have any
he won't
with
him? Oh, no. Huh? He told me
okay.
I have to go get a psych. Yeah, whatever. Anyway,
okay.
Sorry.
So you have no contact whatsoever. He'll be 18. I know it's a long time away, but he'll be 18 4 years.
How do I prove to him that I didn't just take off? That's my biggest.
Do the other two kids talk to him at all?
No.
Do they have contact with him?
No, he won't let him. The father will not let them.
Are they all the same father?
No.
That's why.
God.
Okay.
I have three adult children that I've raised that they're all fine. They're doing good.
Are you still in fear for your life?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know what the evidentiary abuse affidavit is?
Is that like the videotape?
Yeah.
That you
and the
yeah,
document?
Right.
I tell you what, you do me a favor. You're going to do a couple things. Email me at murphymilano@gmail.com, okay?
Okay.
And I'll send you some stuff, and I can talk to you a little bit because this is more than the show is going to be able to handle.
I apologize.
No, that's not what I'm saying. Why are you sorry? That's not what I'm saying to you. I'm saying that I can address you better off the show than I can if you're on the show. So don't apologize.
I just want to tell you thank you. Thank you, ladies, for being, you know, out there. I didn't even know, you know, I started getting activated, you know, in within other groups and stuff, and just I really
are you part of the group with Claudine Dombrowski?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Yeah, I'm
okay.
with
Good.
I do help them. But anyway, thank you. Do you guys have any suggestions for me about my kids? Just telling them.
Again. Please do
I'll
ask
email
them.
You.
Sorry.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Wow,
yeah, I see her heartache. Wow.
It's very difficult for these families. Area code 949, you're on the air. Do you have a question or a comment?
Hello.
Hello.
I'm in support. In support of everybody. This is Tracy.
Tracy Murphy.
Yes.
Hi, Tracy.
Oh. Hello. How are you guys?
You're not related to me, so that's all right. I mean, that's not what I'm just saying.
No, and Murphy's my married last name, or my ex, you know. Yeah.
So
anyway.
Tracy, you see a lot of these cases. You see a lot of these women, like the caller that just called with in regards to, you know, what do I do? And this is going on all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you also
I'm
were
blown
in the
away.
System as well.
I didn't know what domestic violence was 2 years ago. I just learned, and I didn't know that this was what I was living in for 5 years of a relationship. And I'm grateful that I got out, and it takes a lot of work on, you know, our part, and what we're talking about with the kids, that's just as important, and them being traumatized, that's what really, really got me today when you guys started bringing that up, because, yeah, my kids, even though they only witnessed certain things, they, you know, not all of it, it doesn't matter, they still witnessed some of it. They were traumatized, and they struggle with it, and it takes a lot of support, and I'm really thankful that I'm in my kids' life, but my ex did get custody of the kids, and it was the same manipulations, it was the same games, and I almost, you know, I had to really learn how to work with that, just in order to have a relationship with my kids. Because he tried the restraining order with me. He tried putting me in jail. He tried getting the charges pressed against me, and I had to fight myself, you know, free in court. And
again, we're seeing that because look at the killing in California.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody is either moving around or has a bad reception. Look at the killing at the beauty salon where he goes in and shoots. I mean, that was a custody case. That was a dispute. And that's what we're seeing all over the country.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And all the other people that were affected by that, all those people in the salon and all the people in the salon across the street that are now traumatized by witnessing that one person's act of violence.
And it's spilling out into the communities and from behind closed doors, from a court system that really needs Barry Goldstein's book and Barry Goldstein's methodology to work on the system. Lynn Tolson, tell me about how do you get beyond the tears to survive?
That's a good question. The phrase comes from a bit of prose that I wrote that goes like this. It saddens me beyond my tears that love was lost within my fears. In other words, I was so afraid that I couldn't love. Everything and everyone scared me to death. The world at large scared me to death. So I was frozen in fear, and I had to move beyond my tears of shame, self-blame, and guilt. I had to move beyond those tears and beyond those fears in order to feel some love. So to answer your question, it came a little at a time. And some of those things came in very, what may appear to be silly ways. Sometimes they came in tactile ways. I had to learn that not every touch was a hard hit. Like, I would find something I might enjoy, maybe a houseplant, and learn the sensory experience of nurturing a houseplant, that a houseplant was not going to hurt me, that the tactile experience was a sensory experience of learning to love. And it sounds silly, but my body experienced every touch as a hard hit. I had to learn the difference between a warm hug and a hard hit.
How is it, as far as when you started dating somebody, when you started having a relationship, how many times have you been married? Once, twice?
No, I was married once, and that was in a domestic, it was a repeat of my childhood.
Okay, are you married now?
And I am married now.
Okay.
I've been married since 1988, and it is a very comfortable relationship. There is no abuse.
But how have you learned because of what happened to you growing up, how have you learned to accept the relationship and to get out of your own way? One of my favorite sayings, get out of your own way. How have you learned to do that to thrive?
Well, Susan, it's an ongoing experience. I have to be very self-aware, and I have to be aware of what provokes me. I'll give you an example. About 10 years ago, we were going to buy a dog. And one of the themes in my childhood was disposable dogs. In other words, my father liked to go get a dog and then a short time later dispose of it. And if you read J.C. Dugard's story, you'll see the theme where the perpetrator liked to get her kitties and then dispose of it. So there's a lot of loss in that. So my father liked disposable dogs. We'd get attached, and then he'd take it away. So my husband wanted to get a dog, and we talked about it for months. We picked out the litter. We picked out a Sheltie. The day of getting the dog, I freaked out. And I had to be conscious on that day and slow down and breathe with him and be with him. That this was not my childhood. This was the here and now. This was the adulthood. This was my husband. We were going to get a dog for the long term. And my husband realized with me that this was a trigger for me. This was something from my past. He worked with me. He breathed with me. He understood me. He showed me his compassion. I received it. I got out of my way, and we had the dog for 10 years.
Trish McKnight, how about you with you know, you have had many relationships, situations. Now you're married,
yes.
Again, correct? Okay. So how has it been now? Pardon me?
Actually, technically not married. Happily unmarried is what I like to call it. Go ahead.
Okay, you're with somebody now.
Yes,
right.
Yes. Very,
okay.
Very
so
happy.
How is it? How is it now as opposed to when you first started dating, when you first started having kids, when you first started dating, actually? How is it now to then? Have you learned, have you felt like you've learned a lot that other people just don't get it at 18 or 19 years old?
Oh, so much, so much. There has been, I mean, by the time I was that 19 years old, I had, oh, my goodness, there had been so much trauma, and I don't know how many times that almost been killed, but it was so severe that, like Lynn, I did not know what a good touch was. I didn't know that something wasn't going to hurt me, and, yes, I was terrified of my whole world. But it took a long time for me to break that pattern. I mean, I was 37 before I finally decided that I was never, ever going to take another hit, and I ended up having a permanent spinal cord injury from the last beating. But it now is to the point that I always tell myself, and I learned this through therapy, and I live by this rule, and that is not to dwell on my past, to not to worry about my future, but to definitely control my present, because I can't control anything else. And whenever I start worrying about my past, everything is a trigger, because there wasn't anything in my life that was ever good. Nothing. There was nothing. No driving experience. No bathing. There was nothing in my life that was safe or good.
But
so,
for those people that you help, Trish, online, and they don't have options for therapy. They don't have places to
exactly,
go.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why we do a breathing and living in the moment, like Lynn said. You have to be able to control that moment. You have to be able to, you know, if something triggers you, you do have to grab hold of yourself, and you do have to control yourself and just take a moment, recognize that you feel this way, and take a breath and say,
I think, though, that what's also attributed to that is the environment's very toxic.
Yes.
The environment's
Yes.
very dark. It's not healthy, and we don't see that once we're inside.
Exactly.
Do we, Lynn, do we see that once we're inside of this, that how toxic it is for us?
No.
No, because we live in denial, you know, and it's so difficult to leave, and there are so many reasons not to leave, and if we ask ourselves, why doesn't he stop? So the veil of denial is so thick. However, you know, I have to say there are moments of clarity. I'd like to tell a little story if I can. Do we have time?
Yes.
I remember it must have been a Mother's Day, and I was about 15 years old. And the reason it must have been a Mother's Day is because on my father's side of the family, all the women were gathered around this dining room table, and they were having cake. And there was my grandmother, my father's mother, and he had five sisters. And they were all grown with their children, and all my cousins. And so there were a lot of women around for Mother's Day. And there was a lot of craziness and chaos, and people were drinking, and the men were out in the yard, and they were brawling about. And I announced, "I am never having children." And the women were aghast. "How can you say that? You're only 15. Of course you're going to have children. Every woman has children." And what I was thinking was, I am not going to bring one more person into this crazy family. And I never did have children for that reason. I did, if I could not protect myself, how was I going to protect another child in that family? And that was a moment of clarity that I stuck to. How, I don't know, but it was some kind of premonition, some kind of very precocious moment, and I swore that I would never have children. I did everything I could to not have children, and I'm 57 without children. And you know, believe me, it's a conversation stopper. When people say, you know, "How many grandchildren do you have?" And I have to say none. But that was probably one of the things that I think I did to save my children from the world, was to not have any.
Very powerful for a 15-year-old.
It is.
That's awesome. Tracy, I mean, that is really good.
Thank you.
Tracy Murphy. Tracy, you know, you speak to a lot of women. Like I said, you're a mom without custody. You've had custody in the courts as far as issues and divorce and things that have happened to you. What do you get a lot of people to get a hold of you. What do you say to them as far as what they need to do to move forward and be strong?
First is take care of yourself. You know, put your oxygen mask on first, and that's what I had to learn how to do.
Trace, if you look at the caller that called before, when she spoke about she's got PTSD and she's got all these issues now because of this
therapy
of taking it and internalizing it so much, it debilitates you. You can't breathe.
Yes, paralyzed. Yeah, exactly. And I think that when you're living in trauma, like you said earlier, you can't see you can't see the light. You don't see a way out. And support, you know, support is so important. Facebook for me was the best thing in the world because I found you. I found so many people that are educated, that know what to do, and I just filled my brain with information. You know, I just educated myself as much as I could, and therapy takes, you know, time, but, you know, education, you can just sit right on your computer and absorb so much information, and it's important to read all these blogs and all these articles, and like Lynn's book and Trisha's book, because that's what's giving us the knowledge, you know, without having to go through the experience.
Well,
and, you know, the childhood stuff, we even realize we're abused when we grow up. Neglect, we think that's normal.
Go ahead, Lynn.
I was going to say a couple of things. There is a term called bibliotherapy, which is using books as a form of self-help. And I was a kidnapped child. I was kidnapped by my father several times from the age of over time. From the first time was when I was four until I was 16. So And each time, no matter how much he wanted to brainwash me, I knew that he was not in his right mind. And I knew what he was doing was not right, no matter what he would tell me. And now I know the terms of parental alienation syndrome. It doesn't matter what they call it now. I knew it was wrong. And I could not wait to get back to my mother. So I just want to put that out there as a measure of hope that the child knows what is going on is not right. Even when my father had restraining orders against him, he still managed to get me. And of course, the laws were a little. Oh, does it matter that the laws were more lax then? I don't know. What matters?
Doesn't matter these days.
What matters is that as the child in the middle, I could not wait to get to my mother. I knew where the love was.
And I think that this also goes towards, in a lot of ways, to what we're talking about. Barry Goldstein has a book. And if people are listening, they need to go to barrygoldstein.net. And he's the author of Scared to Leave, Afraid to Stay. And he's written a book for women who seek, pardon me?
Oh, nothing. Go ahead.
Seek to leave their abusers and for their friends and families and supporters. And it's a path from family violence to safety. And it tells the story of 10 women as they left their abusers seeking a better life. And the book also shows abuse cases, how the court handles legal issues, orders of protection, custody, visitation, support, marital property, and criminal prosecution. It gives you resources. So I encourage people to go to barrygoldstein.net. He's also a writer.
I have.
For the Times. You have the book.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I have the book. I've read the book. It's one of my stepping stones. And, yeah.
It's the Bible,
really,
I think, for now. I mean, if we don't have a lot of resources. We don't have a lot of things because once you get past the trauma, it's a great beginning.
Right.
And because the system is such that people aren't out there advocating like Claudine Dombrowski out in Kansas City, who took Topeka by storm. As they turned out the lights, she turned them on for the country while they were trying to repeal the Domestic Violence Act or ordinance, which they did do. She's made the world know about it, and that's what one person and how one person makes a difference. And here's a mother without custody. Here's a mother who has fought the system for 16 years. Here's the very system that hurt her down, did everything possible to make sure that she didn't get out of the boxing ring. And here she is 16 years later taking on Topeka, Kansas, taking on city government, taking on the managers, Chad Taylor, Dan Stanley, who are looking to do what they feel is important behind closed doors, which is what they were trying to do, and cut off basically services to victims in the city. And that's a very dangerous precedent to set when no one's looking, when no one's watching.
Mm-hmm. All they're doing is giving them another chance to come after them and make it right the next time, kill them. Is exactly what they're giving them a chance to do. They're just giving them a chance to come back and kill them. Because now they've even got charges against them, you know?
But
so
that's why everybody that's listening has to be able to do, before they say they're going to leave the relationship, before they say that it's over with, before they announce it or go see a lawyer, they need to go and get a hold of the evidentiary abuse affidavit and the process and video in the book Time's Up. SusanMurphyMilano.com. There's a reenactment of the video. You can get the book, as all the books tonight, on Amazon.com. But you have to do this, because if something happens to you or if you're not able to talk, this doing the documentation that has to be witnessed and noticed along with the video will ensure that your words will be heard no matter what, whether this person is around
exactly.
or you're around or not. And that is so important. And at the end of this month, we announce the technology that's going to be out there for the world that goes towards this process that will
so
go a long way to change this, because the system is not responding to these lives. And, you know, we talk about our childhood to help people. Yeah.
I'm really excited about this. Can I just inject something here real quick? I was thinking about this today whenever I was getting ready and actually just kind of jotting myself down some notes here. And I really, something really hit me while I was in the kitchen this morning. And, you know, with these repeated offenders, and you know how it's hard for women to leave. You know, I mean, the studies show that, you know, they go back 7 or 8 times before they finally get out, you know, but women keep getting hurt and hurt and hurt, and they stay in and they stay in and they stay in. You know, God only knows why, only we do, but, you know, someday something hits us and we're ready to leave and we make that decision. But in the meantime, you know, if you don't have the domestic violence laws to back you up, you know, I mean, I was talking earlier about how many times I had almost been killed by the time I was 19. At the age of 9, I looked down the barrel of my first loaded weapon. By the time I was 19, it was a regular. And, you know, my ex-husbands used it as intimidation and threat and control. And I'd get woke up in the middle of the night with a, you know, their hands around my throat or a gun pointed at my head, drag me out of bed and take me in and try and drown me in the bathtub and, you know, just all of these different acts. And at that one moment, instead of pulling the trigger or keeping me under the water, you know, they let me go for whatever reason. They just stopped and walked away. But
Wow. It
could have gone in the other direction at any time. And that stuns me more than anything else. And when I think back on that and how many times I honestly, sincerely was almost killed, and sitting cowering naked in a corner while somebody held me at gunpoint or trying to escape the hands of somebody choking me or trying to crawl with a bloody head gushing blood or whatever the case, there was, you never know how psychotic the beatings or the offender, rather, is going to get. You never have any clue. You can't judge how psychotic they're going to get or how violent. You may think, oh, it's just a slap. Well, next time it may not be just a slap. You don't
that's
know what
that evidentiary.
Absolutely, absolutely. You need all the documentation. You need something. You've got to protect yourself. And, you know, Susan, since I started talking with you, that is something that I tell the girls that I talk with, especially one-on-one. If I've got somebody really having a hard time and we're doing one-on-one talking, it is. It's all about documenting. It's about getting your book. It's about getting
It should be no matter what at the beginning. It shouldn't be when,
you know,
the fire has started or the sirens need
absolutely
to go. It should be
yeah
the first sign of trouble, because you may get hit so hard or something may happen to you that you're not going to be able to do this.
You know,
and,
I mean,
and so it's for your own protection.
I have no clue how I survived. None whatsoever. Why I survived up to this point, I have no clue. Only by God's good graces, let me tell you. Only by God's good graces. But anyone that is in that situation, I mean, absolutely, document it. Tell somebody. Do something.
Go ahead, Lynn.
Keep people informed. Sorry.
Another reason, can I say another reason why I feel that the evidentiary abuse affidavit is so important is because if you do, let's say, document everything on this easy to, you know, your little phone, you can do it so easily now. If you do that, then by the time, let's say, we do make it to the police, because you got to remember, too, we don't always report all the incidences. You know, there's plenty of incidences that should have been reported usually that didn't. Well, let's say something finally does happen, they're going to wonder, well, you know, was it the first time, this or that? Well, you have that evidentiary abuse affidavit already tucked away. That it's going to make that whole case, the whole case just run so much smoother. You know, the detectives, the investigators, they're going to have their work done for them. They're not going to, you know, we don't have to worry about them messing up evidence and so on and so forth. Anyway, that's my two cents.
I think it goes to the bigger picture, just of, like I said, of your safety. I think that when Pastor Neil and Shori and I, we began them in the church in Naperville after Stacy Peterson went missing on October 29th, 2007, and she was the wife of Drew Peterson. that when these were put together and finally something that it was a process, that you saw these women that were in the worst situations psychologically realize that they also had hope somewhere, and that no matter what, somebody's going to know something. Because I think that, Lynn, you would agree that in all of this, nobody ever knows anything when they're a victim, do they? Your mind is such a playground, and you're so afraid to say anything to anybody that it's so difficult, and you can't make sense of it, and you're alone. And the importance of trying to do some things that will help yourself are so important to your survival, whether it's therapy, whether it's the church, whether it's your family members or the community or the person that you're married to. Would you agree?
Yeah, Susan, I'm listening. I remember telling a friend, I was about 23 and married in that abusive relationship. And up until that time, any relationship I was in was abusive because I did not know that there was anything different. And if anything different approached me, of course I would repel it because I didn't recognize the good. Anyway, I was about 23 and I kept losing weight, and I did not have access to the funds at in that marriage, which I would like to talk about sometime, financial abuse. Anyway, a seamstress, I had seen her name at the apartment complex laundry room, and she was at the apartment, and she was pinning clothes for me to alter them, and the husband walked in, and he was really fussing and fuming and saying, oh, if she wasn't such a skinny runt, I wouldn't have to pay for her clothes to be tailored, and she's such a piece of work. And Sally, the seamstress, had pins in her mouth, and she challenged him and said, how can you talk about her like that? And he got pretty pissed off and said that we were worthless women, and he slammed the door and left. And Sally said to me, does he always talk to you like that? And I just sort of shrugged my shoulders, afraid to respond to her. And I said, yeah. And she said, after some time, she said, it sounds like he's abusing you. And I'm making this brief, okay? You know, a period of time went on before she was that challenging. And I said, no, he never beat me with a broom. He never pushed me down the stairs. And I never considered the wax on the head and the punches on the arm and all the other, the kicks on the butt. You know, I never considered all those other activities abuse. I denied it. And I look back on that and I realize how little I knew about domestic violence and how I didn't know the definition until she brought it up. And shortly after that, I started seeing a therapist, and I saw the therapist on the sly, because if he knew that I was seeing a therapist, he would sabotage it. And eventually that therapist helped me get away from him, but it took 2 years.
But I also think the two in all of this, and, you know, that what many of those who go through this, either childhood or adults, is that they punish themselves. They punish themselves as far as what goes on. They blame themselves, and they sabotage their future. And And you know what I'm talking about, Lynn, and,
yep,
and Trish, and
yes,
Tracy.
Yes.
I mean, it's so common. I'm not deserving of this. I don't deserve to have anything good. I don't deserve to have a good life. And you can't do anything because there's nobody to really talk to. So, and then
you're
that
so
next
trapped
step, a lot of times, pardon me?
Oh, I was just saying you're just so trapped within their web, within their cage.
But you get into your own web, and you get into your own entrapment, and you get into your own quicksand, and you don't have a rope to get out.
Yes.
So isolation is the worst thing that you can do. Not having support, not having anybody to speak to, having a pity party with yourself, me, myself, and I always say, it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You have to find somebody to talk to. You have to have somebody support you and lift you up. You have to have somebody to go have coffee with. You have to have somebody who will just listen, because when you are isolated and by yourself,
it won't work.
Because you have these conversations with yourself. A lot of women leave the state or they leave the country with their children, and they have no one else to talk to. And that when things get or go bad for them, they don't take the responsibility of decisions that they made. Instead, they want to blame everybody else. It's because they have no support. They're not going to speak to anybody. They're not going for help anywhere. And we don't have a perfect world. So, Lynn, if we could, if there's one thing that you learned all these years, would you be able to tell anybody how important it is not to sabotage themselves?
Oh, yeah, and you know, not just in that broad term, I want to say how important it is not to sabotage yourself financially.
Hmm.
I will admit that I am in a position now where the lack of self-worth has carried forth into my 50s, and I'm in a position where I sabotage myself financially, and I'm paying for it now because of that feeling of not deserving. And I know where it came from. I know when it happened. And I never quite got to the point where I worked myself into the self-esteem that I deserved to earn the living that has the value in the marketplace that makes me worthwhile or
but
feel
we're almost
worthwhile.
Out of time, and you make
and
a very good point, but Lynn, but the sabotaging of your life, that goes beyond the financial of it. If you could tell somebody who's listening right now, what would you say to them?
Your life is worth everything, financially or not. You are worth your life. You are worth it. You have value.
Trish McKnight, what would you say to those listening right now?
I would say everybody deserves to have roses. And you've got to believe that you deserve as much love as you give to anybody else. You deserve safety. Most important, everyone deserves safety. No matter what's going on in their world, they deserve safety. Everybody deserves to be loved. Everybody deserves to have their own happiness, and you can't give up on yourself. You've got to hang on to yourself.
And how many times did you, Trish McKnight, how many times did you give up on yourself?
Oh, repeatedly.
More than you have fingers to count on?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I fell down in that hole so many times. I didn't think that anything good was ever going to come of my life.
Is the hole covered up now, or is it still there?
No, that hole is covered up now, Susan. I am so genuinely happy that I can honestly say for the first time in my life, I'm safe, I'm loved. Financially, of course, it's not, you know, I always undermarketed myself professionally, but, you know, we do those things. I have to accept myself for who I am. And I accept me with my flaws and all, because I carry a lot of physical scars from the neglectful abuse of my mother and the emotional and psychological traumas of what went on with the incest and the repeated domestic batteries and everything else. There's a lot of damage that I carry, but every bit of your damage is beautiful and it's well-earned. And you have paid the price, and now everybody deserves to have roses. So you need to go out and plant your own roses. And
Tracy Andrews or Tracy Murphy, you've got a couple of boys, right?
Yes.
Two. Okay. How has it been with what? Who is making that noise? How has it been with what they've seen as far as boys? To then for you to try to say to them, this is not right. This is not what we do, and you don't hurt and hit.
Respect. Respect. We talk about respect all the time. I think it really boils down to respect, I think about that all the time because of what they have seen, and what the statistics
say. How old are they now?
They're 15 and 16, and this is the first year they have girlfriends. So this is really interesting, and they're both going to homecoming this year. So I'm on a whole new level playing field right now. And we're going to see, you know, how so far they're doing great in school. You know, they've got straight A's. They're on the varsity football team. They're doing excellent. And now we're working on relationships. And so
maybe that's
far,
something,
so
too,
good.
That somebody can bring up as far as a general kind of a discussion that can happen prior to prom or prior to homecoming in the scope of, like, all the kids kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they know quite well around me.
Not them, not just them, but the other, but their peers or the ones that they go
mm-hmm.
to school with.
At their school, absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
So maybe
absolutely.
There's something that you can do to go in to say, you know, this is, we all take responsibility. This is what we all have to do. It's not so much about telling your story.
I like it. I like it a lot.
It's more about saying there's an accountability here and, you know, boys and girls, and this is what we expect out of you. And so if the parents kind of got together, and again, this mm-hmm. is not a pity party for whatever happened to somebody or didn't happen to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
This is
no,
about what you
prevention.
Can do now. And so you've, when it's homecoming at the end, what, the end next week, isn't there something, in 2 weeks?
Yes.
Homecoming?
Yes.
Okay.
Next week.
So is there a PTA at this homecoming school?
Oh, yeah. I think that I'm
okay.
going to get on the horn with them right away. See if we can
or make
them
listen to the
Friday.
End of the show, one of the two, and just say that this is so important because this is how things happen. This is that if everybody realizes that there's a new stance besides what kind of dress you will come to the prom with, that you won't come with alcohol on your breast, but that you will come with respect for the evening,
respect.
For whom you're with, and regardless. And this is about having a good time and a memory, not making one with hurting somebody.
That's right. That's right.
And that, thank you. That, I mean, that's really, I think that should be something that during homecoming and proms, that's what
mm-hmm.
moms should do. That, maybe that's, I just gave you an assignment now, Tracy
Murphy. I love
Murphy.
It. I'm on it.
That's your project. For all the schools in California, and then you can carry it on. Come up with a little program, and you'll be fine.
Yes, I agree.
The hour's gone by very fast. Thank you to Tricia McKnight. And Lynn Tolson, Trisha McKnight is the author of My Justice, the story of her childhood destroyed by sexual abuse by her stepfather and severe neglect by her mother. The behaviors learned and accepted as a child led McKnight to make bad choices in her adulthood, and the violence continued for many years until she said enough. And also Lynn Tolson, author of Beyond the Tears, a true survivor story, begins with her suicide attempt in the aftermath. She commits to counseling, and the reader learns to accompany the you through your therapy sessions and shows the dysfunction in families and relationships, including incest and domestic violence. And basically, your story illustrates physical, emotional, and spiritual transformation. Both the books, My Justice and Beyond the Tears, A True Survivor Story, are both available at Amazon.com. If anybody needs anything, I can be reached at timesupforjustice@gmail.com. This happens to be National Domestic Violence Awareness Month, so in support of that, go to the schools, create an awareness campaign, get it out there during prom. I think that's something that we can all do. Support Claudine Dombrowski in the efforts as she continues to keep the lights on in Topeka, Kansas. Again, you can reach me at timesupforjustice@gmail.com. Until our show on Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern, everybody stay safe and God bless, and thank you to our guests. Good night.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.